Main Street, desperation, regulator time. As on their previous run, the vans appear like phantoms. Only this time, it's not mist from which they appear, but blowing desert dust. Cassie's pink dream floater comes first, with Candy behind the wheel in his pinned-back cavalry hat, and Cassie herself sitting beside him. On the roof, the Valentine Heart radar dish is turning briskly, like a sign on a whorehouse roof, Johnny Maranville might have said had he seen it, but he does not. He is lying on the floor of the Carver's kitchen, next to old Doc, with his hands laced together over the top of his head, and his eyes squeezed tightly shut. On his face is the expression of a man who expects Armageddon, and soon. Dream Floater's stubby wings are extended, its wheels partially retracted. It cuts through the air about 3 feet above the wheel ruts of the street, its engine pulsing steadily. As it passes the Lady Day on the corner, its firing port irises open. Laura DeMott from the regulators leans out. In her delicate white hands is not her Derringer, but a shotgun. Just a double-barreled shotgun, but when she fires, the report is as loud as a detonating backpack missile. It's followed by a short, high-pitched wail, and then the front of the saloon explodes. There's an instant of flicker across what remains of the saloon's front, almost like a heat wave, and for that one instant, everyone looking would have seen the easy stop, behind the burning Lady Day, like a double exposure. The convenience store also half-demolished and burning. Behind Dream Floater comes Tracker Arrow, and behind Tracker Arrow comes Freedom. Freedom's polarized windshield slides down again. Major Pike is currently behind the wheel of Bounty's van, but the Confederate uniform and pinned-back hat are gone. Candy has the hat on now. The regulators are always trading back and forth. It's part of the fun. The Major is wearing his iridescent motocop's uniform again, and without a hat, his blonde mohawk do shows to good advantage. Sitting beside him in the nav pit is the grizzled trapper type Johnny spotted earlier, Sergeant Mathis, Jeb Murdoch's chief aide after the beating and capture of Captain Candell. Collian Trajan's house has been replaced by the Two Sisters Millinery, where can be found the finest in ladies' fashions. Sarge leans out, draws a bead on the storefront with his shotgun, and yanks the triggers. There is another shattering double crash, and again that long, wailing shriek, as of a bomb falling dead center true down the gravity well toward its target.
Make it stop! Susie screams. Oh, please! Somebody make it stop!
The top half of Two Sisters seems to lift off in a storm of boards and shingles and glass and nails. Again there is that flicker, almost as quick as a hummingbird's wing, and in it Entrajan's house may be glimpsed, even Carrie Ripton's bike and plastic-covered body, shimmering like the mirages they have now become. Then the house is gone, and it's the Two Sisters again, with half its roof gone and all its windows blown in. From the Badlands north of Poplar, where Bear Street now isn't, the silver Rooty Toot power wagon appears. Rooty is behind the wheel, his eyes flashing on and off. Little Joe Cartwright is next to him, devil may care grin on his face, a shotgun chrome-plated with futuristic swoops and doodads in his hands. Directly behind comes the Justice Wagon, and behind Justice there appears a humming electric nightmare. In the bone light of the moon, the meat wagon looks wrapped in black silk. No Face is in the steering pit. Countess Lily is in the nav pit, her sexy dark eyes gleaming in her ashy face. Jeb Murdoch is above them, in the doom turret, in the prime shooting station, because he is the meanest. And so the final power wagon assault begins, with three vans swinging into the force corridor from the north and three more from the south. Hideously amplified shotgun blasts shake the air. The Cattleman's Hotel, formerly the Sauderson House, is shivered backward on its foundations. The left side slumps, then actually crumples, spitting off dry boards and wooden shingles.
The house north of it, a wattle and daub construction Brad Josephson would never have recognized as his own lovingly maintained split level, explodes outward, shooting jagged chunks of wood and slabs of dried mud into the air. On the other side of the street, the false front of Worrell's Market and Mercantile, once Tom Billingsley's house, disintegrates under a series of rifle shots from the justice wagon. Colonel Henry is driving. Poked out of the firing trap and doing the shooting is Chuck Connors, the rifleman. His son is right next to him, grinning from ear to ear. "Good shooting, Pa," he exclaims as smoking boards from the false front ignite the decades' worth of trash and dust that has been hiding behind it. "Thanks, son," Lucas McCain says, and turns his missile-firing Winchester onto Lushan's Chinese Laundry. Lushan's, once the home of Peter and Mary Jackson, has been pretty well bashed about already by Rudy Toot, but that doesn't deter him. His son joins in, firing a pistol. It's a small one, but every round from it sounds like a bazooka shell just the same. At the end of the run, a haze of gun smoke hangs over Main Street. Several of the houses on the west side, the adobe hacienda where the Gellers once lived, the log cabin where the Reeds hung their assorted hats, the wattle and daub Brad and Belinda once called home, have been almost totally destroyed. The cattleman's is still standing, more or less, and so is the two sisters on the east side. But the mercantile will soon join the Owl, formerly Hobart's place, as ash in the wind. Only one house on the east side of the street remains as it was before the regulators came, the Carver place. There are bullet holes in the siding and broken windows from the previous assault, but on this run it has been completely untouched. Dream Floater, Tracker Arrow, and Freedom have reached the north end of what used to be Poplar's 240 block. Rooty Toot, Justice, and the Meat Wagon have reached the south end. The firing slackens, then ceases entirely. The people in the Carver house can hear the crackle of fire from the other side of the fence. The market and mercantile they still think of as old Doc's bungalow, but otherwise there is a deep quiet. In it, the survivors cautiously raise their heads. "Is it over, do you think?" Steve asks, in the tone of someone who doesn't want to come right out and say it wasn't as bad as he thought, but who is thinking it. "We ought to," Johnny begins.
"I hear it again,"
Kim Geller cries from the living room. Her voice is high, shivering on the edge of hysteria, but the rest of them have no reason not to believe her. She is the closest to the street.
"That awful humming! Make it stop!"
She rushes through the door into the kitchen, her eyes bulging and crazed.
"Make it stop! Get down, Mom,"
Susie calls. But she herself does not stir from beside Dave Reed, who is lying with one arm around her and his hand against her breast. Susie doesn't mind his hand a bit, would mind, in fact, if he took it away. Her terror and her almost maternal concern for the surviving twin have combined to make her really horny for the first time in her life. Kim ignores her daughter. She goes to Audrey, grabs her by her hair, yanks her head back.
"Make him stop!" she shouts into Audrey's pale face. "You brought him here. Now make him stop."
Belinda Josephson moves fast. She's up from where she's been lying. She's across the room, and she has Kim Geller's free arm twisted up behind her back almost before Brad can blink.
"Ow!"
Kim screams, immediately letting go of Audrey's hair.
"Ow! Let go, you black b—"
Belinda has taken all the tiresome racist shit she intends to for one day. She yanks Kim's arm up even further before she can finish. Susie's mom, who supports the Girl Scouts and never sends the Cancer Society lady away empty-handed, shrieks like a factory whistle at quitting time. Then Belinda turns her, hips her, and sends her flying back into the living room wall. All around her, Hummel figures tumble to their doom.
"There," Belinda says in a businesslike voice. "She had that coming. I don't have to put up with that kind of—"
"Never mind," Johnny says. The humming is louder now than it has ever been, a steady, cycling beat, like the sound of a huge transformer. "Get down, B. Right now, everybody." Then he looks almost apologetically at Seth Garin's aunt.
Can you make him stop, Aud? She shakes her head.
It's not him. Not now.
It's Tuck. Before she puts her head back down, she sees Cammy Reed looking at her. And there is something in that dry glance that frightens her more than all of Kim Geller's shouting and hair-pulling. It's a serious look. No hysteria, only flat murder. Who would Cammy murder, though? Her? Seth? Both? Audrey doesn't know. She only knows she cannot tell the others what she did before leaving. That simple thing that might solve so much. If the window of time she's hoping for opens. If she does the right thing when it does. She can't tell them there's hope. Because if Tuck is able to reach out and catch hold of their thoughts, all hopes will fail. The thrumming grows louder. On Main Street, the power wagons are rolling again. Dream Floater, Tracker Arrow, and Freedom are closer to the Carver house and reach it first. They park in line, the red Tracker Arrow with Snake Hunter behind the wheel in the middle, blocking the driveway where the Lord of the Manor is lying dead. The other three, Rudy Toot, Justice, and Meat Wagon, come up from the south end of the street and lengthen the line of vehicles. The Carver house, ironically a ranch-style home, is entirely blocked off by power wagons. From the firing pit of Dream Floater, Laura DeMott trains her shotgun on the smashed picture window. From the firing pit of Tracker Arrow, Hoss Cartwright and a very young Clint Eastwood, Rowdy Yates of Rawhide in this incarnation, have also got the house covered. Jeb Murdoch stands in the doom turret of the meat wagon with two shotguns, each sawed off 4 inches above the cocked triggers, the butts propped against the wishbones of his hips. He is grinning widely, his face that of Rory Calhoun in his prime. Roof trap doors bang open. Cowboys and aliens fill the remaining shooting points.
"Gosh, Pa, looks like a damn turkey shoot," Mark McCain cries, and then utters a shrill laugh. "Root, root, root!"
"Shut up, Rudy,"
they all chorus, and the laugh becomes general. At the sound of that laughter, something inside of Kim Geller, something which has only been badly bent up to now, finally snaps. She gets to her feet in the living room and marches to the screen door beyond which Debbie Ross still lies. Kim's sneakers grit through the broken Hummel shards. The sound of the cycling motors out front, that weird beep, 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 is driving her insane. Still, it's easier to focus on that than it is to think about how that uppity nigger woman first almost broke her arm and then threw her into the other room as if she were a sack of laundry. The others are unaware she's left until they hear her voice, querulous and shrill.
"You get out of here! You just stop it and get out of here right now! The police are already on their way!"
At the sound of that voice, Susie forgets all about how nice it is to have Dave Reed touching her breast, and how she'd like to help him forget the death of his brother by taking him upstairs and bawling him.
"Mommy!"
she gasps and starts to get up. Dave hauls her back down, then clamps an arm around her waist to make completely sure she doesn't get up again. He has lost enough for one day.
"Come on, come on, come on,"
Audrey thinks. Her eyes are squeezed so tightly shut, she can see exploding red dots behind the lids. And her hands are clamped into fists, the ragged remains of her nails digging into her palms.
"Come on, go to work the way you're supposed to. Do your job, get started.
Kick in," she whispers, unaware she's speaking out loud. Johnny, who has raised his head at the sound of Kim's voice, now looks at Audrey.
"For Christ's sake, kick in."
"What are you talking about?" he asks, but she doesn't answer. Outside, Kim moves down the walk toward the power wagons, which are parked at the curb, the only place where there is any curb left.
"I'm giving you a chance,"
she says, her eyes drifting from one weirdo to the next. Some are dressed in ridiculous outer space masks, and the one behind the wheel of the lunch wagon thingy is actually wearing a whole-body robot costume. Others look like refugees from a class in Western line dancing. A few even seem familiar. But this is no time to be distracted by such foolish ideas.
"I'm giving you a chance," she repeats, Go while you still can. Otherwise...
The slide door of the Freedom van opens, and Sheriff Streeter steps out. His star gleams a dull moonlit silver on the left flap of his vest. He looks up at Jeb Murdoch, old enemy, new ally, in the doomed turret of the meat wagon.
Well, Streeter, Murdoch says, what do you think?
I think you should take the yappy bitch,
Streeter says with a smile, and both of Murdoch's sawed-offs explode with white fire. At one moment, Kim Geller is standing at the end of the Carver's walk. At the next, she's entirely gone. No, not quite gone. Her sneakers are still there, and her feet are still inside them. A split second later, with the sound of the twin shotgun blast still rolling away, Streeter screams,
Shoot, goddammit! Wipe him off the map!
Get down, Johnny shouts again, knowing it will do no good. The house is going to disappear like a child's sandcastle before a tidal wave, and they are going to disappear with it. The regulators begin firing, and it's like nothing Johnny ever heard in Vietnam. This, he thinks, is what it must have been like to be in the trenches at Ypres or in Dresden 30 years or so later. The noise is incredible. A ground zero concatenation of kapow and kabam. And although he feels he should be immediately deafened, Johnny is still able to hear the sounds of the house being blown apart all around them, bursting boards, breaking windows, china figurines exploding like targets in a shooting gallery. Very faintly, he can also hear people screaming. The bitter tang of gun smoke fills his nostrils. Something unseen but huge passes through the kitchen above them, screaming as it goes, and suddenly much of the kitchen's rear wall is just rubble fanned across the backyard and floating on the surface of the Kmart pool. Yes, Johnny thinks, this is it. This is the end. And maybe that is just as well. But then a strange thing begins to happen. The shooting doesn't stop, but it begins to diminish, as if someone is turning down the volume control. It isn't just true of the gunshots themselves, but of the screaming sounds the shells make as they pass overhead, and it happens fast. Less than 10 seconds after he first notices the diminution, the sounds are entirely gone. So is the queer, humming beat of the power wagon's engines. They raise their heads and look around at each other. In the pantry, Cynthia sees that she and Steve are both white as ghosts. She raises her arm and blows. Powder puffs up from her skin. Flour, she says. Steve rakes through his long hair and holds an unsteady hand out to her. There's a cluster of shiny black things in the palm. Flour's not so bad, he says. I got olives. She thinks she'll begin to laugh, but before she can, an amazing and totally unexpected thing happens. Seth's place, Seth's time. Of all the passages he has dug for himself during the reign of Tak, Tak the thief, Tak the cruel, Tak the despot, this is the longest. He has, in a way, recreated his own version of Rattlesnake Number One. The shaft goes deep into some black earth which he supposes is himself, then rises again toward the surface like a hope. At the end of it is a door of iron bands. He doesn't try to open it, but not for fear he will find it locked, quite the opposite. This is a door he must not touch until he is completely ready. Once through it, there will never be any coming back. He prays it goes where he thinks it does. Enough light comes through the cracks between the door's iron lengths to illuminate the place where he stands. There are pictures on the strange, fleshy walls. One a group portrait of his family, with him sitting between his brother and sister. One a photo of him standing between Aunt Audrey and Uncle Herb on the lawn of this house. They are smiling. Seth, as always, is solemn, distant, not quite there. There is also a photograph of Alan Symes, standing beside and dwarfed by one of Miss Moe's treads. Mr. Symes is wearing his hard hat and grinning. No such photograph as this exists. But that doesn't matter. This is Seth's place, Seth's time, Seth's mind. And he decorates it as he likes. Not so long ago, there would have been pictures of the Moto Cops and the characters from the Regulators hung. Not just here, but all along the length of the tunnel. No longer. They have lost their charm for him. I outgrew them, he thinks. And that is the truth of it. Autistic or not, only 8 or not, he's gotten too old for shoot-'em-up westerns and Saturday morning cartoons. He suddenly understands that this is almost certainly the bottom truth, and one Tark would never understand. He outgrew them. He has the Cassie Stiles figure in his pocket because he still loves her a little, but otherwise, no. The only question is whether or not he can escape them. Sweet fantasies which might have been laced with poison all along. And the time has come to find that out. Beside the photo of Alan Symes, a little shelf juts out of the wall. Seth has seen and admired the shelves in the Carver hallway, each dedicated to its own Hummel figure. And this one was created with those in mind. Enough light seeps through the cracks in the door to see what's on it. Not a Hummel shepherd or milkmaid, but a red play school telephone. He picks it up and spins out 248 on the plastic phone's rotary dial. It's the Carver's house number. In his ear, the toy phone rings. But is it ringing on the other end? Does she hear it? Do any of them hear it? Come on, he whispers. He is entirely aware and alert. In this deep inside place, he's no more autistic than Steve Ames or Belinda Josephson or Johnny Maranville. Is, in fact, something of a genius. A frightened genius right now. Come on, please. Aunt Audrey, please hear. Please answer. Because time is short. And the time is now. Main Street, desperation, regulator time. The telephone in the Carver living room begins to ring, and Johnny Maranville's unique ability to see and sequence breaks down for the first time in his life. His perspective shivers like the shapes in a kaleidoscope, then falls apart in prisms and bright shards. If this is how the rest of the world sees and experiences during times of stress, he thinks, it's no wonder people make so many bad decisions when the heat is on. Susie Geller is crying and screaming her mother's name. The Carver kids are both awake again, of course. Ellen seems to be having a kind of emotional convulsion, screaming at the top of her lungs and pounding Steve's back as he tries to embrace and comfort her. And Ralphie wants to wail on his big sister. Stop hugging Margaret! He storms at Steve as Cynthia attempts to restrain him. Stop hugging Margaret the maggot! She should have given me all the candy bar! She should have given me all of it! None of this would have happened! Brad starts for the living room, to answer the phone, presumably, and Audrey grabs his arm. No, she says, and then with a kind of surreal politeness, it's for me. And Susie is on her feet now. Susie is running down the hall toward the front door to see what's happened to her mother. Dave Reed tries to restrain her again, and this time can't, so he follows her instead, calling her name. Johnny expects the boy's mother to restrain him, but Cammy lets him go, while from out back, coyotes like no coyotes which ever existed on God's earth lift their crooked snouts and sing mad love songs to the moon. He's on his feet without even realizing it, following Brad and Belinda into the living room, which looks as if the green giant stomped through it in a snit. The kids are still shrieking from the pantry, and Susie is howling from the end of the entry hall. Welcome to the wonderful world of stereophonic hysteria, Johnny thinks. Audrey, meanwhile, is looking for the phone, which is no longer on its little table beside the couch. The little table itself is no longer beside the couch, in fact. It's in a far corner, split in half. The phone lies beside it in a strew of broken glass. It's off the hook, the handset lying as far from the base as the cord will allow, but it's still ringing. "Mind the glass, Aud," Johnny says sharply as she crosses to it. Tom Billingsley goes to the jagged hole in the west wall where the picture window used to be, stepping over the ruins of the TV in order to get there.
"They're gone," he says. "The vans."
He pauses, then adds,
"Unfortunately, Poplar Street's gone, too. It looks like Deadwood, South Dakota out there."
Audrey picks up the telephone. Behind them, Ralphie Carver is now shrieking,
"I hate you! Make Mommy and Daddy come back or I'll hate you forever! I hate you, Margaret the Maggot!"
Beyond Audrey, Johnny can see Susie's struggles to get away from Dave Reed subsiding. He is hugging her out of horror and toward tears with a patience that, given the circumstances, Johnny can only admire. "Hello," Audrey says. She listens, her pale face tense and solemn. "Yes," she says. "Yes, I will, right away. She listens some more, and this time her eyes lift to Johnny Maranville's face. "Yes, all right, just him. Seth, I love you." She doesn't hang the telephone up, simply drops it. Why not? Johnny traces its connection wire and sees that the concussion which tore apart the table and flung the phone into the corner, has also pulled the jack out of the wall. "Come on," Audrey says to him. "We're going across the street, Mr. Maranville. Just the two of us. Everyone else stays here."
"But," Brad begins.
"No arguments," she tells him. "We have to go right now. Are you ready? Should I get the gun they brought from next door? A gun wouldn't do any good." She holds out her hand. Her face is set and sure, except for her eyes. They are terrified, pleading with him not to make her do this thing, whatever it is, on her own. Johnny takes the offered hand. Her skin is cold, and her knuckles feel swollen under his fingers. It's the hand the little monster made her hit herself with, he thinks. They go out the living room's lower entrance and past the teenagers, who stand silently hugging each other. Johnny pushes open the screen door and lets Audrey precede him out and over the body of Debbie Ross. The front of the house, the stoop, and the dead girl's back are splattered with the remains of Kim Geller, streaks and daubs and lumps that look black in the light of the moon. But neither of them mentions this. Ahead, beyond the walk, where the power wagons no longer stand, is a broad and rutted dirt street. A breeze touches the side of Johnny's face. It carries a smoky smell with it, and a tumbleweed goes bouncing by. To Johnny, it looks straight out of a Max Fleischer cartoon. But that doesn't surprise him. That is where they are, isn't it? In a kind of cartoon. "Give me a lever and I'll move the world," Archimedes said. The thing across the street probably would have agreed. Of course, it was only a single block of Poplar Street it had wanted to move, and given the lever of Seth Garin's fantasies to pry with, it had accomplished that without much trouble. Whatever awaits, there's a certain relief in being out of the house and away from the noise. The stoop of the Weiler house looks about the same, but that's all. The rest is now a long, low building made of logs. Hitching posts range along the front. Smoke puffs from the stone chimney in spite of the night's warmth. "Looks like a bunkhouse," he says. Audrey nods. "The bunkhouse at the Ponderosa." "Why did they go away, Audrey? Seth's regulators and future cops. What made them go away?" "In at least one way, Tox like the villain in a Grimm's fairy tale," she says, leading him into the street. Dust puffs from beneath their shoes. "It has an Achilles heel, something you'd never suspect. It hates to be in Seth. When Seth moves his bowels, I don't know if it's some kind of weird aesthetic thing or a psychological phobia or maybe even a physical fact of its existence, and I don't care." "How sure of this are you?" he asks. They have reached the other side of the broad main street. Johnny looks both ways and sees no vans, just massed, rocky badlands to the right, an emptiness, a kind of uncreation to the left. Very, she says grimly. The cement walk leading up to 247 Poplar has become a flagstone path. Halfway up it, Johnny sees the broken-off rowel of some range hand spur glinting in the moonlight.
Seth has told me. I hear him in my head sometimes. And when Seth talks on that level, he has no problems. On that level, he's so bright, it's scary.
But are you completely sure it was Seth talking to you? And even if it was, are you sure Tak was letting him tell the truth? She stops halfway to the bunkhouse door. She is still holding one of his hands. Now she takes the other, turning him to face her.
Listen, because there's only time for me to say this once. Sometimes, when Seth talks to me, he lets Tak listen in. Because I think that way, Tak believes it hears all our mental conversations. It doesn't, though. She sees him start to speak and squeezes his hands to shut him up. And I know Tak leaves him when he moves his bowels. It doesn't just go deep, it comes out of him. I've seen it happen. It comes out of his eyes.
Out of his eyes? Johnny whispers, fascinated and horrified and a little awed.
I'm telling you because I want you to know it if you see it, she says. Dancing red dots, like embers from a campfire, okay?
Christ, Johnny mutters. Then, okay. Seth loves chocolate milk, Audrey says, pulling him into motion again. And Tak loves what Seth loves. To a fault, I guess you could say.
You put X-lax in it, didn't you?
Johnny asks.
You put X-lax in his chocolate milk.
He almost feels like joining the coyotes in a good howl at the moon, only he'd be howling with laughter. Life's more surrealistic possibilities never exhaust themselves, it seems. Their one chance to survive this is a summer camp stunt on the level with snipe hunts and short-sheeting the counselor's bed.
Seth told me what to do and I did it, she says. Now come on. While he's still crapping his brains out, while there's still time, we've got to grab him and just run. Get him out of Tak's range before it can get back inside him.
We can do it, too. Its range is short. We'll go down the hill, you carry him. And I'll bet that before we even get to where the store used to be, we're going to see one big fucking change in our environment. Just remember, the key is to be quick. Once we get started, no hesitation allowed. She reaches for the door, and Johnny restrains her. She stares at him with a mixture of fear and fury.
Did you hear me say we had to go right now?
Yes, but there's one question you have to answer, Aud. They're being watched anxiously from across the street. Belinda Josephson breaks away from the little cluster doing the watching and goes back into the kitchen to see how Steve and Cynthia are making out with the little kids. Not bad, it appears. Ellen is sniffling, but otherwise under control again, and Ralphie seems to have blown himself out. Belinda glances briefly around the empty kitchen, now open to the backyard, then turns to go back down the hall to the others. She takes a single step, then pauses. It's not entirely dark down there by the screen door. There's moonlight, and these are her neighbors, of course. It's not very hard to tell them apart. Brad is easy to identify because he's her closest neighbor, so close she's been able to reach out and nudge him in the night for 25 years. Dave and Susie are easy because they're still hugging. Old Doc is easy because he's so thin. But Cammy isn't easy because Cammy isn't there. Not in the kitchen, either. Has she gone upstairs or stepped outside through the hole in the kitchen wall? Maybe, and...
You two!
What? Steve asks, sounding a bit impatient. They're finally getting the kids soothed down, and if this woman screws that up, he thinks he will brain her with the first pan he can lay grip to.
Mrs. Reed's gone, B says, and she took that rifle with her.
Was it empty? Come on, make me happy. Say it was empty.
I don't think so, Steve says reluctantly.
Shit fire and save matches, Belinda says. Cynthia is looking at her from around one of Ralphie's slumped shoulders, her eyes widening in alarm.
Have we got a problem here? She asks.
We might, B says. Tak's place, Tak's time. In the den, where it has spent so many happy hours, at the breast of Seth Garin's captive imagination, Tok waits and listens. On the zenith screen, black and white cowboys dressed in ghostly gear ride across a desert landscape. Their passage is silent. Discorporeal now that it is out of Seth, Tok has muted the TV with the best remote control of all, its own mind. In the bathroom adjacent to the kitchen, it can hear the boy. The boy is making the low, piggy grunting sounds Tok has come to associate with its elimination function. For Tok, even the sounds are revolting, and the act itself, with its cramping and its sensations of sliding, helpless exit, is hideous. Now it knows what the woman did. Drugged the milk to bring on not just a single act of elimination, but shivering convulsions of it. How much did she give him? A huge wallop from the way Seth felt just before Tok fled, and now it understands everything. It flickers in a dark upper corner of the room. Tok the cruel, Tok the despot. A little cluster of disembodied lights that pulse and revolve around each other. It can't hear Aunt Audrey and Marinville, even with the TV sound off, but it knows they're there, outside the front door. When they finally stop talking and come in, it will kill them, the man first, and simply to replenish the energy it has expended, Seth's aunt, for what she has tried to do. It will feed on her as well, and she will die slowly, by her own hand. The boy's punishment for trying to stand against Tok will be to watch it happen. Yet Tok respects Seth. He has been a worthy opponent. Since the wino came yesterday, Tok and the boy have been playing a nervy game of stud poker, just like Laura and Jeb Murdoch in The Regulators. Now everything is in the pot, and all but the final hole cards are face up on the table. When they are flipped, Tok knows it will win. Its opponent is only a child, after all, no matter how brilliant the lower courses of his intellect may be, and in the end, the child has believed just a little more than is healthy for him. It knew Seth had planned to drive it temporarily out of his body, and although the exact method was an unpleasant surprise, even that much knowledge is more than Seth knew it had. But there is something else as well. Seth doesn't believe Tok can re-enter him while he is performing the disgusting act. Seth is wrong. Tok can re-enter. It will be unpleasant, painful even, but it can re-enter. And how does it know that Seth hasn't seen this final card, as he has seen some of the others Tok has held, even in spite of its best efforts to hide them? Because he has called his beloved auntie back to the house to help him get away. And when his beloved auntie finally stops hesitating out there on the stoop and comes in, she'll be, well, regulated. Completely regulated. The red lights in the shadows swirl faster, excited by the idea. Main Street, Desperation, Regulator Time.
Did you hear me say we had to go in right now?
Johnny nods. Neither of them sees Cammie Reed cross the street from the adobe church that used to be Johnny Marinville's suburban retreat, to the remains of the wattle and daub that used to be Brad and Belinda's house. She's got her head down, and the .30-06 in one hand.
Yes, but there's still that one question I have, Aud.
What?
She nearly screams.
For God's sake, what?
Can it jump to someone else? To you or me, for instance? A look of what might be relief appears briefly on her face.
No.
How can you be sure? Did Seth tell you? He thinks for a moment she won't answer this. And not simply because she wants to get to the boy while he's still on the Jakes. He at first mistakes her look for embarrassment, then sees it's deeper. Not embarrassment, but shame.
Seth didn't tell me, she says.
I know because it tried to get into Herb so it could, you know, have me.
It wanted to make love to you?
Love, she says, her voice barely under control.
Oh, no.
Tuck knows nothing about love. It wanted to fuck me, that's all. When it discovered it couldn't use Herb to do that, it killed him. I don't think by then it had any choice. Tears are running down her face now. It's used to having its own way, so it kept pushing, trying to get into Herb's thoughts, his emotions, his nerves. What it did to him. Imagine what would happen to one of little Ralphie Carver's shoes if you tried to get it on your big grown-up's foot. If you just kept jamming it and shoving it, oblivious of what you were doing to it and your obsession to wear it.
All right, he says. He looks down toward the bottom of the hill, almost expecting to see the vans coming back, but there's nothing.
He looks up the street and sees more nothing. Cammy is standing out of sight in the shadow of the precariously leaning Cattleman's Hotel. If he had looked north first, things might have turned out differently. For all of them.
I get the message.
Then can we go in? Or have you lost your nerve?
No, he says and sighs.
There's an old-fashioned iron thumb latch on the bunkhouse door, but when he tries to grasp it, his thumb goes straight through. Below it, appearing like something floating up through dirty water, is a plain old suburban doorknob. When Johnny grasps it, a suburban door forms around it, first overlying the planks and iron bands, and then replacing them. The knob turns, and the door opens on a dark room that smells as stale as dirty laundry.
Quick, hurry, she says. He'll be in the downstairs bathroom, off the kitchen.
She moves past him, taking his hand as she does, and leads him into the living room. The floor is tacky with spilled food and soda. There is an underlying sour smell of clabbered milk. The walls have been scribbled over with crayon drawings that are frightening in their primitive preoccupation with bloodshed and death.
Movement flickers to his left.
He turns that way, heart speeding up, adrenaline dumping into his bloodstream. But there are no gun-toting cowboys or sinister aliens, not even an attacking little kid with a knife. It's only a shimmer of reflected light. From the TV, he assumes, although there's no sound.
No, she whispers. Don't go in there.
She leads him toward the doorway straight ahead. Light shines through it, printing a bright oblong onto the food-encrusted carpet. Electricity may not yet have been invented, along with the rest of what used to be Poplar Street, but there's still plenty here. As they enter the kitchen and he looks around, it occurs to Johnny that perhaps the good folk of Poplar Street deserve what's happening to them. She's been living like this for God knows how long, and we never knew, he thinks. We're her neighbors. We all sent her flowers when her husband ate the end of his gun. Most of us went to his funeral. But we never knew. The counter jostles with jars, discarded packaging, empty glasses, and soft drink cans. Many of the latter have become ant farms. He sees the Tupperware pitcher with the remains of the doctored chocolate milk and the crust of Tuck's bologna and cheese sandwich beside it. The sink is stacked with dirty dishes. Beside the dish drainer, a plastic bottle of detergent lies overturned. Around its nozzle is a long, congealed puddle of green dish goo. On the table are more stacks of dirty dishes, a squeezed bottle of mustard, sprays of crumbs, an aerosol can of whipped cream, two bottles of ketchup, one mostly empty and one mostly full, open pizza boxes littered with crusts, bread wrappers, Twinkies wrappers, and a Doritos bag pulled down over an empty Pepsi bottle. There are also piles and piles of comic books. All those that Johnny can see are issues of Marvel's MotoCops 2200 series. Spilled sugar pops are scattered across the cover of an issue which shows Cassie Stiles and Snake Hunter standing hip-deep in a swamp and firing their stun pistols at Countess Lily Marsh, who is attacking on what could be a jet-powered motor scooter. Bayou Blast, the title screams. In the far corner of the room is a heap of bulging plastic garbage bags, none secured with ties, most oozing ant-infested swill. All the cans seem to bear the smiling face of Chef Boyardee. The stove is covered with pots encrusted with the chef's orange sauce. On top of the fridge, a bizarre crowning touch, is an old plastic statuette of Roy Rogers mounted on the faithful trigger. Johnny knows, without having to ask, that it was a present to Seth from his uncle, something perhaps remembered from the days of Herb Weiler's own youth, and patiently hunted out of a dust-covered attic carton. Beyond the fridge is a half-open door, casting its own wedge of light out onto the filthy linoleum.
Seth,
Audrey Stage whispers, dropping Johnny's hand and rushing for the bathroom door. From behind them, spots of dancing red light stream out of the den's arched doorway and flash across the dark living room toward the kitchen. As they do, Cammie Reed steps through the door from outside. She has the gun in both hands now, and as she stands looking around the dim living room, she slips her right index finger inside the trigger guard. She is hesitant, not sure where to go next. Her eye is drawn to the flicker of reflected TV light from the den, her ear to the sound of people moving in the kitchen. The voice in her head, the one demanding revenge for Jimmy, has fallen silent, and she isn't sure which way to go. Marinville and Weiler are in the kitchen, she's sure of that. But is the killer brat in there with them? She glances doubtfully toward the TV flicker again. Maybe autistic children watch it with the sound off. She has to be sure, that's the thing. There are probably just a couple of rounds left in the 30-06, and they likely won't give her a chance to pull the trigger more than once or twice anyway. She wishes the voice would speak up again, tell her what to do. And then it does.